U.S. factory activity slowed.
Based on hitting a shareholder value as market capitalization.
A lot more global. So creating more programming not only for, you know, us here in the English-speaking U.S.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio, high above the Chicago River on this sunny summer afternoon. Summer is here. The sun is around as well. A lot of fog right along the lakefront, so we can see the fog near us, but the sun is up there too. And I know that most of you are listening away from the lake and are probably, you're working on your tan. You've maybe flipped once or twice and things are going to get better because summer is inevitable. In the studio this afternoon is Andrea Haines, who is not working on her tan right now. Welcome.
Hey, Steve.
Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
You can see, it looks like it's a nice day out there, isn't it?
It is. The fog is weird, though. It was weird driving home last night. Yeah. It was suddenly like, what is happening?
What is happening in the workplace? I love this story about younger workers angry now with older workers. Americans are working longer and longer, right? And so the people who are on their way up on the ladder are saying, hey, get off the ladder. That's my spot. I need you to retire.
Yes. Yeah, so something like 45% of younger employees under 50-ish think it's a problem that they're just people are hanging on to their jobs right. too long. And then the young people feel like they can't move up.
Is it a problem?
It's a little bit of a problem. You know, obviously, depending on who you ask. I mean, what are you going to do? You're older. You need health insurance. You need to work, whatever your case may be. You're probably still a good worker, right? What can you do?
Nearly 20% of Americans over the age of 65 were employed or actively looking for work last year, up from less than 12% 20 years before.
So much for the, you know, the sort of golden parachute or the gold watch at age 60 or 65, right? It's a couple interesting factors here. One is that, men are more likely than women to say this, and affluent respondents are also more likely to say it. So obviously they're ambitious people who may look at their own company and think, hey, I want that job. And if that person doesn't leave, you know, I'll never be able to move up.
Okay, but so that explains it. That's a good point then. So these are people who are already pretty well off, who want to be weller off.
And not necessarily entirely, but the numbers are a little bit greater in that population.
Right. And so what about this idea that it's bad for the economy to have older workers still working?
Two sides on that, right? You definitely need young people to have money to buy houses and do all those things the economy wants them to do. There's another side of that argument, though, which is same goes for older people, right? If they're making money, they're helping the economy. There's, a good effect there for everyone.
Right. The more money being generated, the more money being spent, the hotter the economy would be.
And then that creates jobs that young people can fill, right?
I like that one of the experts in the story said it's really a micro-macro thing. If you look at it from 1,000 yards up, is that a phrase? I don't know. It's really not a big deal overall. But if you're in an office where your head of marketing has been there for 40 years and you want to be head of marketing, you want her to retire. You want him to retire.
Yes, very true. And one thing I thought was interesting as a member of Generation X is it's often this like, well, millennials are saying this or that. And they were like, well, actually, it's not a problem because it's only affecting Generation X. It's not really affecting millennials. And I was like, wait a minute. That
you're
feels
right.
like a problem to me. It's Generation X that is really crushed behind the baby boomer generation. And perhaps the generation that will really wind up never getting those jobs because by the time they do come open, the millennials will be ready for them.
It's like Prince Charles. He'll never be king.
That's exactly right.
There's a great story as well. I don't know if it was in the front page of the Trip Today or in maybe in the business page about looking at rideshare programs in Chicago and the impact that they've had. Have they made traffic better or worse?
Yeah, they've made traffic worse, which is probably not surprising. This is really a story worth reading. It's a very deep dive into, you know, some of the promises that companies like Uber and Lyft make when they want to come into a city. One of those promises is that they will help public transit and they will make traffic better. And, you know, in this case, not so much the case. Like, it tends to be transit-rich areas with wealthy people where the most rideshare rides are happening.
Four or five neighborhoods, right, where most of the rides are happening.
Yeah, it's predominantly the Loop, near North Side, near West, Lakeview, and Westtown. So all these very central areas really are dominating the popularity.
And the CTA clearly has fewer rides. I mean, there's got to be an impact there, right? Why would I take the CTA if for a dollar or two more, I can go door to door?
It's a few dollar savings, obviously, for the rider, but at the cost of what, half an hour? I mean, half an hour can be worth a lot in your day. And something that is touched at the very end of this story, which I, again, really recommend reading because it's a deep dive. But something they get to at the very end that I think is worthy of its own coverage is just how uncomfortable and inconvenient transit can be. I mean, God love it, but it's like maybe this causes them to address some of the issues that push people for the cost of a few dollars to just have that more comfortable and efficient experience if they can afford to.
How would you fix it? What would you do? I mean, I get that, but...
You know, I'm sure there would need to be a multi-million dollar analysis of like who exactly isn't riding and how to get them.
Right.
But that probably needs to happen, right? I mean, transit needs to grow and adapt to people's habits just like everything else.
Here's a line I like. As of March, there were 66,562 active rideshare drivers, so Uber, Lyft, or whatever, who make four or more trips a month. 66,565 compared with in March of 2015, so 4 years ago, 15,000.
Massive
so more than four
increase.
Times the increase.
Massive increase. And I think traffic has gotten worse again. I think perhaps with the recession, traffic had gotten significantly better around downtown, at least in my on my route, you know, on a daily basis. I perceive it as getting much worse again. And one thing they go into here as well is the drivers aren't trained. You know, I mean, really, they're not trained the way cab drivers were trained. So even little habits they have or they don't know the neighborhood, there's subtle things they can do that are actually slowing down traffic more.
Oh, I see.
If they're less experienced drivers and don't know the city.
Now, there are limits on cab rides, right? You can only have so many cabbies in the street, but there's no limit right now on rideshare drivers.
Exactly. I mean, this is one of the big issues here is that, you know, taxis were so heavily regulated, you know, in terms of how many there could be and what rules they had to follow. And then Uber and Lyft came in and, you know, that was kind of out the window.
And yet, the Chicago riders are the highest taxed in the country when it comes to rideshares?
Yes, and some of that money does go to
the
things
CTA
like the CTA.
And, right.
So the idea there is, yes, you may have people spending more on this, maybe not ideal, but some of that money via taxes is getting funneled back into public transit.
Andrea Haines came here from the Chicago Tribune, and the good news for you is you can just walk down the pedway, and
yes.
You'll be fine. No need for an Uber or Lyft.
Exactly.
Thanks for coming by. Have a great weekend.
You too, Steve.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. All right, job market is very hot. Everyone has a job. Everyone has, well, some people have two jobs, I guess, out of more than just a desire. But things are hot. Tom Gimbel is here, the CEO and founder of LaSalle Network. Tom, welcome back.
Always good to be with you.
Okay, so what are you seeing now as far as some of the trends in hiring?
So the interesting thing is people think with low sub 4% unemployment that it's really easy to find talent, right?
Right.
Because everybody's can go really wherever they want. People quit jobs without having jobs. But for a lot of companies, it's actually harder to find people for a couple reasons. Number one, places where people are currently working are offering them money in advance of them leaving.
Say that again.
So if you're managing a team or you're owning a company and people have left, you're now doing stay reviews.
Oh,
and you're
okay.
saying, before you even think about looking, I'm going to give you a 10% increase.
So so they're just throwing money at their workers in order to keep them.
To an extent. I mean, hopefully they do it in a formalized way and review what they're making. But they say, we don't even want you to think about leaving. And if you just got a raise of 10 or 15% and then you get a call from somebody, maybe you don't take that call.
Shouldn't a boss always be trying to keep their employees from looking around?
You should, but there's buyers. Buyers markets and sellers markets, right?
Okay.
And you're going to see different times. So right now, when it's really an employee-driven market, you're seeing employers say, let's be ahead of the curve a little bit.
Okay.
So you see that. And then you also see companies see the fact that on the flip side, employees don't necessarily want to leave their company because they're you read about it in the paper and on the news that employees don't want to be the low man or low woman on the totem pole.
So you don't
if
want
the
to go,
economy crashes.
You don't want to go somewhere else and be the last one in, first one out.
Exactly right. So
okay.
If somebody will offer you money to stay, you're like, wait a second, I can get more money and the devil I know is better than the devil I don't. And then most importantly that we've seen right now is in our we're advising a ton of people is if you get a counter offer, really think hard about accepting it and staying.
Okay, talk me through that. So I decide I want to go to greener pastures.
Yep.
I go over and I interview. I get a job offer.
Yep.
And then I come back to you and I say, boss, I enjoyed it here. I'm leaving on June 30th.
And the boss hopefully says, why did you want to leave? Well, this opportunity and the money. And so let's talk about the opportunity first and see if it's really that different.
Mm-hmm.
And if the reasons aren't, I hate my boss, I hate the with the location of my job, and it ends up being more about money, say, if we can come close to that number, right, or even at that number.
Or beat that number.
Or maybe beat that number. Would you stay? It's very similar to sports, and we talk about that all the time, but it's you get the hometown discount or don't you?
But see, I would think that would be typical, that you know you would come back and say, hey, I just got offered this job, really would like to, you know, just to try to sweeten your own deal. I'd really like to stay here. Can you match it?
You'd be surprised. I would tell you that probably less than 15, less than 10% of the population goes to get a job hoping to get more money.
But they don't go back and say, they don't give a chance to match.
Because a lot, well, in a healthy economy, a lot of employers, because no one's perfect, Steve, right? And so companies are going to say.
You're about as close as I've found.
Funny, I was thinking the same thing about you.
I was hoping so.
Companies are looking and they're saying, wait, we can do better than this. And there's 7% unemployment, we can find it.
Right.
In today's economy, they're saying, we can't do better than this.
Okay, but you were telling me off the air that accepting that counteroffer has been kind of frowned upon in the past.
In the past, it's been a little bit taboo of they're just doing that to put a bandage on the situation and they'll be looking for your replacement tomorrow. And that's really evolved and changed as companies have become, they're called boomerangs. Somebody leaves and then they come back.
Uh-huh.
And that's become a lot more common in business today. The companies are accepting that people want to go try something else. Even just interviewing to see what's out there and then coming back, and it's a competitive market, but it's okay to accept the counteroffer.
So that those boomerangs are because they're coming back because they need the talent.
Yeah. Well, if somebody leaves and goes to another job, the greener pastures, per your comment,
right.
And then they realize it isn't so green.
They'll still take them back.
And they'll call back and they say, can I come back?
Who loses in this endeavor? It sounds like the recruiters would lose a little bit.
Recruiters lose a little bit, but if they actually have the best interest of the client and the candidate at heart, which they should, it comes back.
All right, so give me the pulse generally. Are things still as hot as they've been?
Unbelievable.
Really?
I've never seen it. I mean, I say that every week, I think, but I've never seen it like this. And now I don't see the correlation to the stock market as much as I used to.
Tell me about that. What do you mean?
Meaning that companies used to look at the stock market and go, it's going up, so everything's going to be good. Well, we've had 6 weeks of down, right? 6 weeks
good.
In a row of not growing in the stock market, and actual declines, and I still see the CEOs and CFOs I talk to every day are saying, we're still bullish on the economy. It's just become volatile. We're not worried about it long term.
Now, how long is this going to last?
I think we'll see.
I have one graduating in May.
I think you're good.
Next May.
May of 20?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're good.
No kidding. You think this is going to last
I think another
long?
18 months.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people are very happy to see that.
Well, I don't know if I'm a prognosticator, but I believe it.
You are now. If you said it here, it better happen.
I think it will.
Tom Gimbel, the CEO of LaSalle Network. Follow him at LaSalle Network?
Yep, and at Tom Gimbel.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Eric Rung. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You know, a week ago today, it was a Friday afternoon, obviously, and we were looking at the deadline for the state legislature. They had to get all of this stuff done. They had a midnight deadline. Well, as it turned out, they extended into the weekend, but wrapped up by Sunday night. And we're still just sort of learning everything they passed, because they passed a lot of stuff. One of the things that they approved funding for was this one central transportation hub, a new hub, just as I understand it, west of Soldier Field. Amtrak will be there, Metro will be there, CTA. Joe Cahill from Cranes has been looking at it, and he's not sure it's something that we need. We'll talk to Joe about that a little bit later in the program. But before that, the Fed is on a listening tour. It was in Chicago just this week. Did you get a chance to talk to the Fed or maybe one of the governors? They are looking at the way they do things and wondering if maybe it's time to recalibrate. David Beckworth is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, a former international economist with the Department of Treasury, and he joins us on a phone line this afternoon. David, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Well, thank you for having me on.
All right. I don't know that the Fed's going to listen to me. Maybe they will listen to you, but what are they listening for?
Well, I think they've chosen this time for two reasons to go on a listening tour. Number one, the economy is doing relatively well. It's a peaceful time. They want to, you know, if they're going to make any big changes, they want to do it when times are calm, which makes sense. But the second reason, though, is I think they're worried and they want to get prepared for the next big downturn, the next big recession. They're concerned that they won't have all the ammunition or tools in place to fight the next recession based on what they learned in the last one. And also because interest rates, which is what they normally adjust to stimulate the economy, they have a target interest rate.
Right.
They're really low. I mean, their target rate's 2.5%. Historically, the Fed is every recession on that. Well, not every, but on average, they have cut interest rates about around 5 percentage points, and they only have about 2.5. So they don't have a lot of ammunition to cut rates and they want to make sure they have something in play in case a recession comes around.
Well, but from what I heard from Powell's speech here, in fact, to really move the markets this week, was that he seemed to indicate, or at least give fuel to those who want, another rate cut this year, or maybe two rate cuts.
Yes. No, so that's more of like a current issue.
That's more immediate.
Fed,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So the listening tour is more kind of a long-term, what should we do differently? Should we target something differently? Right now they're targeting 2% inflation. There's different ideas out there, target the price level, target average inflation, as well as additional tools. Should we do nominal negative interest rates? Should we target the yield curve? And then there's the current developments, which you just mentioned, which is that the economy seems to be slowing down because of trade issues. And as a consequence, you know, Powell opened the door along with some of the colleagues that they might be open to a rate cut. The market is pricing it in, a great chance in the July meeting, less of a chance in June, but definitely more than before the Chicago conference.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry, I sort of derailed my own conversation here, so we'll get back to long-term in a second. But when it comes to the short-term, then, so you're saying July, I had heard before the September, but they're not going to wait that long?
Yeah, I mean, well, let's put it this way, the market is really getting antsy, and they're pricing in, they're expecting rate cuts, a high chance of it in the July meeting. I mean, some are even hoping June, but June's probably too soon. And the interesting thing is the Fed now goes on a blackout period starting right tomorrow, which they can't talk to the media. So if market expectations run ahead of reality, it's going to be a tough juggling act for Jay Powell at the next few meetings.
How much of what Powell and the Fed does should be, well, not dictated, but I guess I should say, how much attention should they be paying, or are they paying to Wall Street?
I think they're paying definitely attention to inflation expectations, and the market itself has kind of a built-in measure of that. I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but if you look at U.S. Treasury bonds, there's a way to infer what the market thinks is going to happen to inflation in the future, and they really care about that. So on that front, they definitely care. If they see a sustained decline in stock market and other asset prices, they would follow that as well. So they are mindful of that. So there's both the trade war, which is more of a fundamental issue they're concerned about, but they're also concerned about what the bond market's telling them in terms of right expected inflation. And so they are mindful to some degree.
Okay, so let's go a little longer term now. They have this goal of 2% inflation, and they can't quite seem to get there. Is that what we're talking about, to figure out how they can more likely meet that goal or manage inflation?
Yeah, that definitely is one part of it. Again, the other part of it, are they prepared for the next downturn? But yes, they have not hit their own inflation target since they bought it online in 2012, and one could argue even before then. Before 2012, they were implicitly targeting around 2%. They made it official 2012. So effectively, for the past decade, they have, on average, not been able to hit their own inflation target of 2%. So they are considering other tools, other ways to get there. I mentioned negative interest rates as one potential tool.
Yeah, explain for me, how does that work, David?
Well, normally you think of interest rates being positive, right? I mean, you don't go to your bank and say, hey, I want a negative 3% on my checking account or savings.
Right.
But that's what they're talking about, is bringing in the possibility of actually lowering rates beyond zero. And that's been done in Europe. It's been done in Japan. Now, there's a limit to how far they can do that because of physical cash. At some point, you might tolerate minus 1%, minus 2%. At some point, though, you're like, okay, I'm not going to take minus 5%. I'm going to start, maybe using cash again. At some point, it becomes worthwhile to substitute out. But they are at least thinking about going a little bit farther down than they have in the past.
Is the incentive for that, or is the point of that then to incentivize people to go out and spend their money rather than try to save it and fuel the economy that way?
Yeah, I mean, that's the traditional story, is they cut rates, they stimulate the economy. It's just that normally they have more room to cut. So, for example, going into the 2008 crisis, they had rates up near 6-5%, so they had plenty of room to cut before they got to zero. Today, we only have rates at 2.5%. That's the short-term rates. And so the Fed's worried, it won't be able to bring the same ammunition to the game if there is a game to play in a recession.
One of the things they're looking at is this average inflation targeting. Can you explain that for me?
Yeah, so the idea there is to make up for past mistakes. They want to, if they have a 2% inflation target and they have undershot it for a while, then it implies they're going to have to be over it for a subsequent while, subsequent period. So the goal is truly to hit your target on average. And again, the Fed hasn't done that. So the idea is effectively you'd make up for past mistakes where today, bygones are bygones. Water goes under the bridge. You don't care. I aim for 2% today. If I don't hit it, I'm sorry I missed it, but the only thing next year we'll do is 2%. With average inflation targeting, if you miss 2% this year, you might have to go above 2% inflation the subsequent year.
I see. Okay, and another one, NGDP level targeting. I don't know what that means.
Okay, yeah, that is a mouthful for sure. But the way to think about that is a way to, instead of targeting inflation, target total spending in the economy. So it's not, and let me be very clear, it's trying to shape the path of total dollar spending by the private sector and how much households spend, businesses spend. And you don't want them to spend too much, but you don't want them to also to hoard funds and not spend it at all or not enough. So stabilized total spending is one other option under consideration. It's very popular academically. I'm actually a big fan of it myself. I don't think that's in the cards. I think that's a long ways off. Probably something more likely would be the average inflation approach, because it's just an incremental step from where they are today.
So you think that's what's going to end up happening? If we're a little bit short, it's okay. Then if the next year or two we're a little bit over?
I think that's what's going to happen. Again, it's not my preferred approach, but yeah. If you look at all the proposed alternatives that the Fed's considering, one thing they all have in common, so the nominal GDP level target, there's also a price level target, which is similar to average inflation targeting. What they all have in common is they have this makeup element. They don't let bygones be bygones. If the Fed misses its target, it has to account for it in subsequent periods.
David Beckworth, the Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center. David, it was great talking with you. I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. So summer's pretty much here, and that makes a lot of people happy. And the city of Chicago is trying to share that happiness with even more people by doubling the advertising budget to campaign and bring tourists into the city. $15 million are going to be spent to convince out-of-staters on TV commercials, online videos, outdoor campaigns, and more, which is great news for us. But it's not just Chicago making the pull. There are state parks that are all around, small town feels, and they're easy to get to because of our lovely state highways. By the way, this ain't one of those commercials. So if you're feeling a little cooped up, check out something new in your own backyard. And if you need to try something else that's new, then Scoot's footwear could be your saving grace. You're probably going to feel good about your impact on the earth because the shoes are made from pineapples and 95% organic material. The company came from the Northwestern-based entrepreneur hub, The Garage, and after some additional classes at the Chicago School of Shoemaking, the prototypes started to come together. Shoes will officially be available for shipment come August. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.